come with us now, if you dare, down a rickety staircase into a dank, dark basement. What awaits? The Saturday Night Freak Show.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Saturday Night Freak Show podcast. We're a movie review podcast where every Saturday we get together, watch a movie, and then talk about it ad nauseum for your listening pleasure and education.
There's going to be a lot of nauseam on this one, I have a feeling.
These are the internet radio superstars who are going to talk about it.
Sean.
Holly.
Michaela.
And I'm Colin. And who picked the movie tonight?
Colin!
All right, so I chose the 1984 David Lynch movie, Dune. Okay, so...
Spice.
We're going to try briefly. Let me see. For those haven't seen the movie, I'm going to try and summarize what it's about. We're going to see if I can do it in less than 5 minutes.
Can you even remember names?
Strangely enough, I can.
But how many times have you seen this movie?
Several, and I read the book, so that also. But I mean, like, you know, Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings.
Well, that's what I'm saying. This is why you love Game of Thrones.
I was going to say, Colin and I have had multiple discussions about Game of Thrones, and he's rattling off names, and I'm like, you know, the Night Chick. Like,
yeah.
I have no idea who anyone is.
Right,
yeah. The Dothrakians and whatnot.
See, I have no trouble with Game of Thrones characters ever, but this movie... doesn't matter. I don't even like. I try and it's gone. The next scene, just
no,
it's
I'm
gone.
Like, you know,
the doctor. Arrakis, yeah. Harkonians, Paul,
Harkonnens,
Harkonnens.
Okay. Yeah,
I mean Paul.
Paul.
That's, I think one Remember of the problems with any. Well, I don't know if it's a problem
Alphabet
with
soup.
The story. I think a problem with any film adaptation of Dune. Is that it uses a lot of like manufactured language,
yes.
like mm-hmm. Sardaukar and Lanzrad and you know Muad'Dib and all this other stuff. Whereas like comparably, Star Wars uses words like blaster,
yes,
mm-hmm. Lightsaber. You know, I mean, there's Death Star. It's like stuff that you're like, okay, well at least these are English words. And you're just changing the association.
Sure.
Where this is like making stuff up and throwing it at you like crazy. All right, so here we go. Dune, for those of you who are new to this, is about a group of warring feudal houses in the future. 20,000 years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
10,191.
Yeah,
that's the year.
There you go, Michaela's got it. And they are all battling... over the substance called
the spice,
which is manufactured only on one planet,
Arrakis.
Called Arrakis, which is also known as
Dune.
There you go.
You're doing way better than I am.
That's all I got. I'm empty.
So the two houses are the House Atreides and House Harkonnen, and they have like this blood feud, and there's a whole bunch of skullduggery and political infighting and betrayal and all this stuff that takes place basically as they try to control this substance spice, which basically comes down to the combination of like a hallucinogenic drug, and if you take enough of it,
you become God?
Changes your consciousness. And if you, you know, as in the case of the Fremen, but if you take enough of it over 4,000 years, you become a space navigator and you are able to fold space and interstellar travel
what?
Is possible through use of the spice. Ergo, it is the most valuable commodity in the known universe.
Didn't get any of that.
Yeah.
What? They like, there's
that,
narration
I, yeah, I got
at
that.
The beginning that lays this out for
you. Okay. Easy enough.
So Dune started as a 1965 novel by a guy named Frank Herbert. It is one of the, I mean, the novel is considered one of the titans in science fiction literature, standing alongside Ender's Game, mm-hmm. The Fountain, is it The Fountainhead? Isaac Asimov?
Oh, I have no idea.
I know
Battlefield Earth or the Mission Earth series. There are 18 Dune books.
What?
Yeah, that's what I said.
Only like four to six of those, I can't remember, were written by
now
Frank Herbert. His son's
this
writing the rest.
Just on the first book?
Yes.
Or is this, okay, this is just the first
book. This is
book.
Just Dune.
But the first book itself is 400 pages.
Right.
So it's no...
It has
it's no pamphlet. Yeah.
It has a glossary. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those where you kind of have to like study to... No, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like a textbook at that point.
Yeah.
Cool.
Now, Colin, you have you own the book. You've read the book. How
Colin bought the book in 1984, still has it.
I know. I was telling Sean, it's like, but in 84, like I couldn't actually go to. I was a kid, right? I was thinking 10 years old. I couldn't go to see the movie, but I was able to buy the book, so I read the book.
Did you follow? At 10? Did you follow the book? Well,
it was one of those. I don't know. You read it and you remember certain moments from it, and all of those moments that I remember are in the movie. You know, but I don't know if the visual style of the movie has altered the way that I think of it. Because now, when I think of these scenes from the book, I see the designs of the of the film itself.
The designs of the film. We should. I mean, we could speak at length on that, like the influence it's apparently had on. Filmmakers later on in life, certain aspects of it. I mean, things I saw right off the bat. I mean, just the obviously the most obvious one is the sandworms,
right?
Which
that prowl the planet Arrakis.
Which I mean, we can name tons of things. Beetlejuice, obviously.
Return of the Jedi.
Tim Burton. That's what I know. Like Return of the Jedi when he like I told Colin in the middle of the movie when the George Lucas went back and redesigned the Sarlacc pit, he adds. A beak to it, and the beak, the thing that comes out of the middle of it, looks just like one of these. It's only got like two, an upper and a lower mandible, but like these have three, but it looks just like one of these sandworms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's funny you say that because David Lynch passed up directing Return of the Jedi to make this movie.
He was offered, because David Lynch had done Eraserhead, which is, you know, if you haven't seen Eraserhead is like, I mean, it's bizarre. It's experimental. Yeah. It's like a nightmare kind of caught on film. The only way that I can explain it is like you never meet the person who's dreaming. This is their nightmare. And then he did a dramatic feature called The Elephant Man, which is a really good movie with John Hurt, who just passed away recently.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And this, I think, was his opportunity to graduate into like big budget mainstream movie making. The only problem is you're David Lynch, and so there's no way that's ever going to happen.
Right. You're David Lynch, and this is Dune.
Yeah.
At some point, this is going to be inaccessible to people.
Yeah.
Man, can you imagine there's a parallel universe out there, though, where David Lynch directed Return of the Jedi? Like, I want to see that movie.
God. A lot of dissolves.
He's like, I want to change everything.
This will have a great meaning. Because that's the thing. I don't think, like, there is that undercurrent in the book of, you know, like, the dreams are guiding Paul. He takes a lot of, but, like, the movie, you know, that kind of the inner journey and, like, you know, you drink the water, you have an acid trip. There's, like, this kind of, and that imagery is very David Lynchian. I mean, a lot of the designs and the creatures and stuff like that, the, you know, ships, they're just odd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lots of triangular shapes and stuff like this where, you know, it's obviously, to me, a director trying to be, like, unlike anything else that's been done in science fiction. It's like, I want to do something that's unique. Mm-hmm. Well, it's unique. Does it work? That's maybe another question. David Lynch was not the first guy to try making this movie. And that's actually kind of why I wanted to bring it up and watch it. Because
it's torrid history?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just been announced that Denis Villeneuve, the director of Arrival and Blade Runner 2049, Sicario, this guy is going to try and make Dune, right? Like, so this is his next project. He's gonna try and tackle Dune and all that entails. So it's like this process is still going on. It's like they've tried, but they started in the 70s. The Chilean filmmaker Alejandro Jodorowsky, who, like David Lynch, started off in like midnight movies. He made a movie called El Topo, which is like this really fucked up, surreal.
It's fucking awesome, though.
Western.
Yeah.
It's cool. And the Holy Mountain.
Yeah.
And I like Santa Sangre also.
Yep. That whole trilogy is. They're independent of each other, but like they fit together nicely.
Yeah. And but he's a surrealist, right?
Oh, for sure. So. I mean, Holy Mountain guy like shits in a jar and it turns into gold. Like that's the kind of movie.
He literally shits gold in this movie.
Yeah. What? So, yeah.
All these people make a pilgrimage to see. It's very weird.
And you picked this. We could have been watching the shitting gold movie and you picked this. Well, all right.
The door is open for the future. All Alejandro Jodorowsky hasn't been properly enshrined on the Saturday Night Freak Show yet.
Not
I think
at
El
all.
Topo might be a better start, though.
Yeah, probably.
I want the shitting gold movie.
There's weird shit in El Topo. Don't worry. Okay. I said it was a Western, but that's not entirely.
Oh, there's like a town of like small people that live underground in El Topo that are really disturbing. Yeah.
He's very much like, you know, I mean, I guess all surrealists, David Lynch included, it's, you know, a lot of the imagery that seems to appear in their films is motivated by, like, you know, it's their own inner life. It is like stuff that he sees in dreams, nightmares, or in his imagination, which is just off kilter, you know, it seems, with everything else that anybody rationally attempts in an emotion picture. But that's kind of what gives him the – but Jodorowsky's version is one of the famous what-if movies that never happened, where he famously – was going to cast Orson Welles as Baron Harkonnen. He was going to have Keith Richards as, I think, Duke Leto. He was going to have – or no, sorry, as the Emperor. I mean, it was like Pink Floyd was going to do the music. He got H.R. Giger to do design work. He got Mobius, who did, you know, the Heavy Metal magazine, to do design work. Dan O'Bannon was writing the script.
I'd watch the shit out of this movie.
I know, exactly, yeah.
You're but saying all the right words.
There's a documentary about how
Jodorowsky's doing. Yeah,
yeah, and there's a beautiful art book, too, where you can see all the concept art for it. That it's just – it's absolutely stunning book.
Well, because that's his you know – even though he was denied the opportunity, the funding, basically. Because
is that why?
Yeah. People looked at this and was like, A, this is going to be 10 hours long. It's going to be fucking weird. I mean, it's weirder
you're
than
weird.
What you got.
This is going to be weird.
I mean, when you see some of the art, you're like, I don't know how they would have pulled this off. If especially in like 1975 or whenever they were attempting this, it would have been the biggest sci-fi movie ever made. It would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars in 1975 money. And so there was just no feasible way, I don't think, to actually pull it off. But he says in his storyboards, you know, basically if you go look at his in the art book, it's everything. He's like, I shot it in my head. It's like, here is the entire movie of Dune, you know. Ridley Scott also was recruited by Dino De Laurentiis to attempt it. Said he went through five drafts. And then he had a death in the family, and so he gave it up. But he ended up being introduced to, through Jodorowsky's project, all the people who then went off to make Alien.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
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 So that's how, like, Alien came. I mean, like, the legacy of Jodorowsky's Dune, even though it failed, I think is, like, one of the things that, like, you know, kind of stretches over and influenced science fiction movies.
Yeah.
And pop cultures in many ways ever since.
And he's still rather sour about how that all went down too. Cause like there was even something relatively recently where he said he, up until a certain point, he had never seen David Lynch's Dune because he was just like so heartbroken that his movie didn't get made. And then he said once he actually watched it, he couldn't stop smiling because it was so bad.
Yeah.
And so he was so petty about like it being,
so but he was at the time, you know, the heartbreak was doubled because he was like, if anybody, you know, was going to do it, the worst person to him was like, oh no, David Lynch, like he would be the guy who, you know, if
it'll
not
be better
David
than mine. Lynch, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. And then after this movie, which I don't think that it's that we're spoiling anything to say that in 1984, it was savaged by the critics of the day. I mean, was it a bomb? It cost $40 million in 1984 dollars. That's the equivalent.
I did the math. $99 million. Yes. So this is like a big budget Marvel movie tanking hard because it only made about $30 million.
So that's like 75, 80 million on a $99 million dollar budget.
Yeah.
In the year 2000, it was attempted for television. So they made a three-part miniseries on the Sci-Fi Channel. Which is, you know, I suppose more to the letter of the novel in many ways. The design work to me, looking at it, you know, is kind of not as compelling. It's, you know, very flat, very TV, very claustrophobic.
Very sci-fi
kind of thing. Yeah, very.
Sci-fi like
they're
channel,
turning that. Yeah. Right. They're going down the hall and turning the corner, but there's nothing beyond that corner. I know it.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Even
set
like
design,
when they're outside just, in the desert, it's like, okay, we got like a patch of, you know, some sand and we're shooting it from above.
Yep.
So you can't see the edges of it. But
what,
it,
the,
they
what
got
do the worms look like?
They're in a sandbox.
In a sandbox. I can't even remember if there were CGI in that worms. But William Hurt plays Duke Leto now, and I think that was their big get. Yeah. So Yeah. Okay. So this movie happened.
It happened to us.
Lynch has famously gone on record. Like, he doesn't talk about it. I think like Universal actually came to him and said, like, you know, there's still interest in this movie. It's a cult classic now. Like, mm-hmm. we'd like to get you back and like put together your version of it. Because, you know, he said that he didn't have final cut. Mm-hmm. So he mm-hmm. was like, I'm distancing myself from this movie. I never want to talk about it again. And he's turned down any offer to come back and revisit it.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Even though they did put together a 2-part TV movie using footage that was cut out. And that one's credited to Alan Smithy.
Of course.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Yeah. So he was like, no, I'm not, I'm done. Huh. I mean, as a career comeback, he had Blue Velvet, which got him an Academy Award nomination for Best Director.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose that's one of the upsides of mm-hmm. like, if you're going to kill your career with mm-hmm. Dune, you know, go Blue Velvet. And then he's just been doing his own stuff ever since.
Oh, yeah. He said he considers this his biggest career failure. And he said it's too painful for him to talk about. Like, he won't even do DVD commentaries. He won't. Nothing. Just wants to pretend like it never happened. So.
I wonder if you cornered him on the street, though. Would he just shun you? Or would he say, thanks for liking that
Shout
movie?
Shout profanities and walk away.
Yeah. I don't know.
How is he as far as being personable interviews and whatnot? Is he somebody who talks about his stuff? I've never seen interviews with him or, you know, the movie sites. I've never seen anybody interview him. Like, is he a recluse or is he kind of normal? Because he seems like he'd be an eccentric. Yeah. Just that's my perception of him.
Well, this is your first time ever watching a David Lynch movie, right?
It is indeed, I think.
Well, I don't know how
I still, I haven't seen Mulholland Drive.
Not Blue Velvet. Not Twin Peaks.
No, I will not watch Twin Peaks.
Why?
It just doesn't, I can't do it. It doesn't look like something that I would want to watch.
It's weird.
I mean, I'm all for weird, but it just doesn't look like, there's nothing, Mulholland Drive is the closest one that I've looked at and seen, like, that looks interesting. I want to watch that. But nothing else of his, I can't. There's just no urge to see his stuff. I don't know why.
Well, in many ways, it feels like, this is me personally, maybe, you know, if you've seen a lot of these, McKelly, mm-hmm. you'll disagree, but the Mulholland Drive seems like it is the crystallization of a style or possibly a subject that he's been after, I think, since mm-hmm. Blue Velvet. It's like there's Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, Lost Highway, Fire Walk with Me.
Yep.
Inland Empire.
That came after Mulholland Drive. Okay. So mm-hmm. that way, I'm not counting that one because it's like
before and after at that point.
Yeah, I'm like, I think he nailed it with Mulholland Drive. Was like, okay, I got it. And then
I lost it.
I find Blue Velvet to be the most accessible of his movies. Mm-hmm. Like, that's my personal favorite.
Wait, you haven't seen The Straight Story? The G-rated movie.
Wait, that's David Lynch?
That's David. Yeah. Yeah, it's like, what?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. You've seen
it? Have you seen a David Lynch movie now?
No, I have not seen this. I know The Straight Story. Yeah. I know the story of it and the guy driving across the country in his lawnmower, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That is the most like linear, like it's a normal movie for a David Lynch. Linear. You're like,
yeah, that's literally linear too. Yeah. Yeah. Just driving in a linear line. Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's based on a true story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe that story captured his imagination. I just want to do this.
Yeah.
Huh.
But he comes off, I think, in like interviews and stuff as a very personable kind of guy. I mean, he's eccentric, but he has like a, he's really like nice and polite and seems like this Midwestern kid who got like transplanted into Hollywood and somehow kept his core by being just like fucking weird, mm-hmm. you know, like somehow that all defended him from losing his, you know, ingrown Midwestern values or whatever. I don't know. You know, you'd have to,
whatever makes David Lynch, David Lynch.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So if this is your first shot, I mean, so, okay. So I guess, you know, we'd say that the most Lynchian thing about, since this is somebody else's plot and story, would be his visual design.
Right. Heavy design and visual.
Oh, he's in this movie, by the way. He was the operator of the harvester. Who was like,
when they rescued him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh. Yep.
Yeah. Director cameo.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Why don't you point that out during the movie?
Sorry, I'm pointing it out for the folks at home.
I was be like, I have to go back in. I'm not going back.
So you were going to bring up the creatures or the ship design or?
Oh, I was just.
It's set design?
The set design. Well, I was, like you said, since it is somebody else's story, the most Lynchian thing is his visuals in this. And I was just commenting on how it looks like it's influenced other filmmakers later on in life. That was my big thing because you see it a lot everywhere. I was even Fifth Element comes to mind when watching this movie. It's like Luc Besson was a fan of this because some of the architecture looks the same, especially in the the Emperor's throne room and whatnot. Just the gold and the angles of everything. Even the suits on some of them look like. If you've seen Fifth Element, it's I can't remember any of it now. Like the alien race that's holding on to the Fifth Element at the beginning of the thing. They're like giant robot looking things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That design is like this. It mm-hmm. takes place. I mean, there's a desert planet on there that also looks similar to stuff like this. Mm. Some of the creatures in those. That seems like it was heavily influenced by that. Mm-hmm. And then everything else being the worms.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much that most it notably seems tremors. Like, you know, I mean, just off the top of my, you know, it's like if the novel was written in 65, I mean, Star Wars takes place where you find the kid on a desert planet. He's going to become basically the savior of the empire.
Yeah.
It's an empire.
Yeah.
There are, you know, the Jedi and the Bene Gesserit, you know, I mean, they're kind of, you know, mental magicians kind of, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of parallels, I think. Like
Even moisture farmers.
Right.
Yeah. Both movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so there's some, you know, I guess, you know, some threads back to Star Wars. There's a scene in Phantasm. I'm a fan of Phantasm. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where he's got to put his hand in a box, right? Mm-hmm. As a fear is the mind killer. And lyrics from songs.
Yeah, what was the song, you guys? Was it Daft Punk?
No.
What'd you say? Oh, no.
It was Weapon of Choice by Fatboy
Slim.
Yeah.
Right.
Use the sample from this or just or the just phrase?
I think the song's inspired by this movie.
Yeah. The chorus words are Walk Without Rhythm and... Oh, what was it? What did he say?
Don't Bring the Worms or...
Walk Without Rhythm and Don't... Oh, fuck. What was
you
it?
Had it.
I know. I'm drunk. I'm sorry.
The drinking started early because the movie's like
so long.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway. That rhythm, don't disturb the worm or something. I don't know.
Whatever don't disturb
whatever
the worm.
Whatever they said in the fucking movie.
Don't
was
drink
word
the
for
worm.
Word.
Don't.
Yeah. I got to look it up. God
it's,
damn it.
It's funny what you're saying about the Emperor's throne room because to me, like, this is my first, I've seen this movie several times. So this is my first time seeing it in like 6 or 7 years.
I was going to say, for someone who protested that they did not like this movie,
I've seen it a lot. Yeah.
And, do people keep making you watch
this? Basically. I did.
Like, Michaela hates this.
That's my boyfriend's perspective. She hates it. Let's watch it. Again. Yeah, exactly.
How do you carve out time to sit down and watch this movie?
So this is my first time watching it since like I've really learned a lot about Scientology. Mm-hmm. And the Emperor's Throne Room looks shockingly a lot like the Celebrity Center in L.A. for Scientology.
It does.
Where they, those videos where you see them putting the weird medals on Tom Cruise and everything's like all gold. And I was like, oh, God. Like, when I saw it, I almost had a little bit of a reaction this time. I was like, oh, this is really, really upsetting because it parallels something I don't want to think about in our real world.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Here it is. Sorry. Walk Without Rhythm, It Won't Attract the Worm. That's what it is. It's literally word for word from this movie.
So they're fans of this movie.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of I mean, there's probably a Wikipedia page somewhere that lays out like all the connections to Dune and pop culture. But I suppose that means that there's something to the story that has this kind of long-reaching appeal. I mean, is it the idea of, I mean, you've got like a messianic character, right, who is born to royalty but has to overthrow. I mean, Paul's character arc, right?
Paul.
That name is just fucking ridiculous for this movie.
Why?
Because it's so normal.
Everything else is gibberish.
Yeah.
Because he's like,
Paul.
He's like, blah, 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 blah. And this is my son, Paul.
Yeah.
Paul and Jessica, the two most normal words in this
Duncan?
Movie.
There was a Duncan.
There was a Duncan.
Vladimir.
You're making
Harkonnen?
That one up. Was his name Vladimir?
Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. Where were you people at? Okay, so this maybe
it was
this,
throwing a lot at us, Colin.
So this might be the crux of the problem with Dune. Then is that what we're saying? It's the language.
It's the language. I mean, it really is, because it's not. It's not something you can. First of all, like you said, they just throw it at you without really context, because it is. I mean, which you can get later on in the movie once you meet some of the people they're talking about. But it is just words they're throwing at us, and we're like, okay, what is that? What is that? You can get kind of the short thread of what is happening, but at the beginning, it's just words, and we're just like, okay, what do these represent? What does this mean? You say these words, but what am I, you know, what am I supposed to acknowledge from that? And it's, again, you pick it up later on, but at the beginning, it's just like, woof, all right, I'm with you. Keep going.
How many times did I go, what?
Yeah.
What?
Well, some of that, though, is like, obviously, you walk into a scene. I think the Baron's nephew, Raban, walks into a scene, and they've got, like, these people have a cow strung up. You know, and he pulls the tongue out of the cow and starts eating it raw.
Deserved a what?
Yeah. Or, you know, the fact that...
he starts flying at just some random point.
Yeah, the Baron is just flying around and pulls out heart plugs and people bleed to death after he coats himself in oil that rains down from the
scene. What the fuck was that with the slaughtering, like, homoerotically,
the weird
one, that
rapey slaughter?
What was that?
Super weird.
I don't know.
It's a planet of gingers.
I don't know that that's in the book. Is that...
How would they even describe that in the book?
Well, I think maybe heart plugs are in the book.
Feels like they'd have to be.
Heart plugs, but how are they, like, and he sauntered over to
him? And he homoerotically murdered him.
Describe that?
I don't even know if the Baron, like, flies in the book. I mean, maybe, you know, I'd have to go back and look at this.
I mean, if he doesn't, that was a really good choice.
Some of this, I wonder if it is David Lynch's, you know, like, that's what he, like, the grossness of some of this movie. There's people spitting in people's faces.
Like, maybe that's just Lynch wanting you to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Like, the spittle of the Baron. Yeah.
Or even that he had all this shit on, you know, the pustules.
His diseases. It's like they're, I think the doctor said it, like, the upkeep on his diseases. It's like they're doing it on purpose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The milking the cat in order to get the antidote that will cure you. You have to do it every day.
Which goes nowhere. They're just like, we brought you a gift.
Yeah.
Tis a cat.
Milk the cat.
With a rat.
Yeah.
And who better to bring you a cat to milk than Sting?
Than Sting.
Obviously.
Ginger Sting.
You know, I think the, like, spitting on people and, like, just spit being, like, present is actually kind of a common thing through David Lynch movies, because Blue Velvet, there's a lot of spit in that movie, too. Yeah. A lot. So
not,
maybe that's,
you're
like...
You're not selling me a movie.
Nope.
It's in a different context, but...
Yeah. But I can't think of it in some of his other movie, but maybe
I don't remember
that's
any
a,
spitting in
it's really leaned on in Blue Velvet.
Yeah. So maybe, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff in this where it just comes off as like, I mean, you know, where Star Wars was basically a PG-rated movie that was accessible to families and kids. This is a PG-rated movie that's clearly, I think, going after the Star Wars audience. Oh, yeah. They didn't have PG-13
yet.
PG-13
didn't exist, yeah.
Yeah. PG-13 came around in 85 with The Woman in Red and Red Dawn, I think, were the first two PG-13 rated movies. But yeah, so I think that overlay of kind of like, you know, nastiness,
that gritty,
comes from David Lynch. Mm-hmm. I think.
I don't think that's necessarily in the book.
Sick motherfucker.
You know what's missing from? Okay, so here's the thing. And this was pointed out.
I'd be hard pressed to tell you what's missing from this.
Well, let me phrase it this way: staples of science fiction that are missing from Dune.
Okay.
Computers, robots. Like, science fiction stories are seemingly always hinge around the technology.
Right.
Where Dune goes the other way, and it's like...
This seems more Egyptian, if that makes sense.
Or Arab, in some way. Some of the words, you know, like, we're waging the holy jihad and, you know, Muad'Dib, or, you
Muad'Dib.
Know. Yeah. All these words have, like, a kind of Arabic, you know...
They did have technology, though.
Right, sliding doors and whatnot.
Yeah. Guns and shit,
In the ships and I just remember the guys in like the little saddles.
Yeah.
It was like computer saddles. Did you see that? I don't know what that was.
I almost said that the technology is subtle in this movie, but then I thought, wow, I'm applying the word subtle to this movie.
Yeah.
I don't think that's correct.
Right. No.
So I'm going to take that back.
Yeah. But they do have like.
But it's there. It's just not at the forefront, it doesn't feel like. Well, they're going for other things at a certain point.
I do remember, like, you know, the whatever, the training robot that drops out of the. Is it a robot? Whatever, the machine. Yeah. There's machines, obviously.
It's like a pillar, like it's a robot fighting pillar. Machine,
yeah. And that, like, assassin pin that flies through the air, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thing, the Hunter Seeker.
Yeah.
The Hunter Seeker.
Yeah.
If I don't move.
But they've trained in the novel. It's explained
syringe.
That at some point. You know, in the past, sometime between now and the world of Dune, that human beings outlawed, like there was a ruling that outlawed all thinking machines, and then they started training people to basically become like computers, and that's where you get the Mentat class, all
Wait,
the people
did they
with
say
the
that?
Stained lips, they're human computers.
When did they say that?
I remember them
several
talking about
times
the red
stain.
Did the princess say that in the beginning? Was she a princess?
Yes. Princess Irulan.
Yeah.
I just remember she said the spice a lot and was fading in and out a bunch.
Yeah.
That's all I gathered from that. Yeah.
You could just say words and her.
Yeah. She was played by, our cast.
Virginia Madsen.
It's quite a cast. Virginia Madsen.
This movie does actually have a pretty solid cast.
Yeah. Like,
Patrick Stewart is in this movie.
Yeah. Patrick Stewart. Yeah.
Looking just like Patrick
Max
Stewart.
Max von Sydow. Yeah.
Max von Sydow.
Jürgen Prochnow.
Jürgen.
Mm-hmm. Brad Dourif.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And like the entire stable of David Lynch regulars,
yep.
including
Kyle
Jack
MacLachlan.
Nance.
Jack Nance.
Yeah, Jack Nance. God, what's his name? Dean Stockwell, because he was in Blue Velvet. Mm-hmm.
It's just missing Dennis Hopper. McClellan, that's Gloughlin. All it needs to complete.
The yeah, right?
What the fuck's her name? Ray Finkel? What's her name?
Oh, Sean Young.
Yeah.
Ray Finkel.
What? What is that from?
Ace Ventura.
Einhorn. Einhorn. Finkel. Finkel.
You're giving me flashbacks.
I know Sean Young. Finkel. Finkel and Einhorn.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to have a crying game moment now?
She was the girl who famously was supposed to be Catwoman in Batman Returns.
Oh, really?
And had like a mental breakdown and lost it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm glad that didn't happen.
I remember hearing about this.
I'm really glad that didn't happen.
Yeah. I know, it's a shame. All right, so Paul's, so the theme of the movie, maybe, Paul's character arc is to...
Become the one.
But by doing that, he has to abandon his royal life and go native with the aboriginal peoples of the planet.
The Fremen.
Yeah.
And then fight back against the oppressive colonial empire.
Yes. I mean, he has like a series of trials throughout the
movie. He does. Paul is also special in that in this future... They have told the women that they are only allowed to have females as children, and that his mother went against that and decided to have a boy. So he's special in that regard.
Well, it's not everyone. This is just all the people of the Bene Gesserit society. So they're all women who have this second sight ability.
Yes.
And they want all, you know, they've been manipulating bloodlines for centuries.
Yes.
Even though they say somehow, like, there's a place in their subconscious, they're like generational subconscious where they can't see past.
Mm.
And it's said in a prophecy that one day a man will come.
It takes a man, apparently.
And he will see into this. How do you guys read that?
Holly, Michaela?
Problematic at best.
Is that a personal message from the people who? I mean, that's got to be something that came from the book, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Book.
So that's we can blame him.
Don't worry. There's
for being it takes a man to do this. A man will come along.
Don't worry. The patriarch will still save you. It's okay.
That seems to be.
And that's like the exact reason Glenn Close turned down being in this movie. Is like she was offered. I don't remember which role, but she was offered a role and she was like, I don't want to just like chase a guy around the desert and have him pick me up when I fall down all the time, is what she said. And that's why she turned
it
down.
She must have been the mother. Though.
Yeah. So that falls in line with that.
How old is Glenn Close?
Well, I was thinking in this movie, Kyle MacLachlan's mom did not look old enough to be his mom in this movie.
She didn't.
They did not look like far enough in age to be mother and son.
But it's the future.
Well, he's supposed to be 15 in the
what?
Book.
What? Yeah.
No.
In the book, he's 15 years old. When he starts out. I mean, years go by. By the time.
Yeah, sure. But he never looked 15 in this movie once.
Yeah.
Like 25. I think
they cast the old version and said, like, well, he'll just play
he'll
young.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the Denis Villeneuve version will have a 15.
Sure.
Yeah, they really did. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Is it just a play on, like, the
Savior?
Messiah?
It's, yeah. It's a play on the Savior, yeah, really. It's a man.
Yeah. And he'll be able to somehow see into the core of, like, the collective unconsciousness, and that'll give him, like, the ability to cause rain.
Yeah. He'll see into the place that apparently the women can't.
Yeah.
Access something.
Do you know what that is?
Do they know what it is?
Yeah. I don't think
they do.
They're trying to explain it in all of these, like, the, you know, there's a couple of recurring right. motifs.
The hand, the water drip.
The moon, ring.
The second moon.
The ring, the moon, yeah.
Yeah.
The ring of
Gianni saying, like, tell me of your homeworld, Usel. Yes. And the repeated refrain of the sleeper must awaken.
Yes.
And Dune, Arrakis, Dune Desert Planet, or yes. whatever. And somehow.
Am I the one? Am I the one?
Okay.
Well, okay.
The fucking inner monologues throughout this entire movie.
Oh, my God.
What the hell?
Those are always.
So distracting. I mean, I have no idea what's happening.
At a certain point, I kind of liked it. I'm just like, oh, what is he thinking now? And then he would just come up with some bit. I don't. Was that all part? I always wonder if that's part of the movie from the beginning or if they went back and added things like that. Because sometimes.
Ooh,
it's
info dumps, yeah.
Sometimes it feels like an info dump. Sometimes it's just like one quick line of something. So, I mean.
He sees it as the truth.
Right. Yeah. But I can't imagine how much you would not understand this movie if they weren't in there. Like,
right.
I wonder if that's a choice to go back and add it so that people will follow this movie at a certain point. Because, I mean, it's hard enough to follow as it is once, I mean, especially at the beginning. But to not have those in there, I mean, I would be completely lost as to specifically what they were going for.
I think it's so jarring because, like, now that you say that, this makes more sense. But, like, it seems like the actors do, like, almost a quarter turn to camera when they
it
do
does.
That.
Yeah.
And then they pause for a second, as in, like, this is where my inner monologue is going to go.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's what makes it so jarring is that, like, it's so pointed.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. But that's also what makes it feel like it was designed to be there. I think I read somewhere where they were saying that that was edited or added in post-production. The opening narration from Virginia Madsen was added in post-production. Oh. But when you're watching it, it's like, I don't know. There is these pauses in their performance where it seems like this is where the inner monologue will come
right.
out. I don't know how else you would interpret that.
Well, you can get that from, I mean, that's, if they do it right, that's just using footage on when the other actor they're talking to is doing their lines.
Mm. Exactly.
Like, if that actor is with them, they will pause to listen to the other actor.
Right.
So on the B-roll footage of that, they can just take that, put that in there. And you just add the voiceover to it. Like, if they did it afterwards and weren't planning on it, that's had to be how they did it.
Yeah.
It is odd because, I mean, just the experience of watching it now, you don't see movies with, a lot of narration, number one. Mm. B, you know, voiceover narration for individual characters. I mean, like, it is seriously every single character in this movie has this inner dialogue, which is explaining, like, how they feel about any given, you know, moment in the film.
Right. I was waiting for, I'm hungry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this also kind of gives it a flavor.
Where's my dog?
Right?
Yeah. Where'd the pug go?
Yeah. My question the entire fucking movie. Where
he ran off into battle with Patrick Stewart, strapped to his chest.
Yeah.
That
amazing.
Was,
and
that
somehow
was
survived
favorite.
In the desert.
Right.
Until
that's
the very
greatest
end of the movie.
Choice of this movie.
That
first, to have the dog. Is the dog in the book?
I have no idea.
Oh, my God.
I'm guessing that's a David Lynch
thing. It feels like that is like...
The royal dogs and the...
Yeah, there's like that guy with like 10 bulldogs in the beginning. Yeah.
Was there? I missed that.
Yeah, there's a guy walked right through the throne room.
It was like right at the beginning, I yelled puppies.
Oh, right. There were dogs. Yes. Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. Puppies. Yes. That makes more sense. I feel like David Lynch has a... Like, that's his dog. That's what I felt like. He's like, I'm bringing my dog to set.
And so goddammit, that dog is going to make it all the way to the end.
All
of
the
movie.
Way to the
fuck
end.
Yeah,
it's
dude.
Really hamming it up at certain points, though. Like, panting with its tongue, like, sticking right out.
Oh, I love that dog.
That was the best choice in this movie.
Yeah. But I mean, as far as the narration goes, like, so you're saying that it was distracting because you're not used to it, or because I'm just curious if it like gives the movie a flavor that's distinct to this movie. Because it's like, well, I mean,
I felt like it was the lazy choice. Like, there are things that they can't physically act out in this movie. They have to actually tell you. To me, that's just kind of lazy writing that they have to do that.
I don't know if they have any other way of doing it.
I agree. I don't know how else they would have done
it. Not to say it's good, but I mean, I did enjoy it as it went on. I'm just like, this is funny.
It gets to the point where you're like, what's he going to think now? Like you said.
Am I the one?
Yeah. That's what was frustrating about it, is that like, if you're going to do it, use it for an info dump or like exposition. Don't use it just for filler nonsense like that. Yeah. And, like, sometimes it was info dumps and sometimes it was just like, I hope he'll be okay. And it's like, why do we need that?
He's talking to his mom. Yeah. And they're both having inner thoughts, like, just talk to each other.
Exactly.
Right. I couldn't tell at some points they were like, because there are people who have a telepathy in this movie. And at certain points, I couldn't imagine, like, are they doing it too? Like, are they talking to someone? Mm-hmm. Is he talking to his mom right now, or is he just thinking something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I couldn't tell sometimes.
Yeah.
I guess that's the fun of trying to figure out. It's like, wow.
Yeah. Then there's
keeps you guessing.
There's the sound weapons, which are also like an interesting addition to science fiction. Whatever.
So they had an actual weapon, but it didn't work without the words. Is that right?
Well, there's a tech.
Because they had like a little box that was shooting stuff, but they had to like talk to the box.
Yeah. It's like a hand-mounted, like a pistol kind of thing.
Like a voice-activated.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and you've got a thing on your throat, the attenuator, maybe, something. That you speak a certain. Well, yeah, because I'm not entirely sure on this. I know that the Bene Gesserit order has the ability to alter their voice in a way that basically does the Star Wars thing where, you know, like you know, these are not the droids you're looking for.
Yes.
You can do that. Only, you know, you sound like, I don't know what, some type of do it now.
Yeah.
And the voice, if you hear it, compels you to do something. So the Atreides or Paul somehow figures out a way to
concentrate it through this mechanism.
Yeah. And certain words trigger our killing words, our breaking words. We can smash like bones and rupture organs by shouting at
this obelisk is of your hardest stone. Kick it.
As for demonstration, all you really have to do is go up there and go, cha!
And that's what it felt like they were doing. Ah, cha! Like they just found a word.
But I don't know why you need, I mean, some type of physical
to filter it through in order. Maybe that it's got to turn that into something else.
Yeah, it's so that's it.
Yeah.
It's
that activates
turning
this mechanism.
The voice into some type of killer energy.
Right. Later on, we find out that Paul, I almost forgot his name. It's easy.
Voice activated weapon generator.
Basically, that he doesn't need it at a certain point.
Yeah, at the very end.
Once we get to the end, once he becomes the one,
very Neo-ish.
Yes, very.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which also borrows heavily from... No, okay.
I mean, there's got to be some influence. Just feels like it.
Okay, so there's voice weapons. There's gigantic sandworms, which, of course, you do not introduce a sandworm into your movie.
Unless you're going to ride it at the end. That's what Chekhov's Absolutely. First rule is.
Yeah. Yeah. Sandworm.
Like, the rule is the gun. The first rule is the sandworm. The worm. Okay. Yeah. Introduce the sandworm at the beginning of the movie, and by the end, you have to ride it.
Yeah, which I think the sandworm is the most enduring icon of any kind of Dune, you know, because I think it was on a bunch of the,
That's all I knew about
the hardcovers.
Yeah.
Somebody maybe it was one of us for the thing, but somebody had, I saw recently a drawing or artwork somebody had done of all like sandworms through time. There was Beetlejuice, there was the Dune worms, there was the Graboids.
Really?
Yeah. I just saw artwork that had them all on there. Kevin Bacon's riding the Graboid and everything.
Oh, wow, there you go.
I'm like, wow. I couldn't remember it. Like, wow, this is opportune that it comes up now that we're going to do Dune.
Right.
Facebook knows. Oh, shit. God damn it.
Somehow it's been reading your,
it knows they're your listening right now.
Yeah.
I'll take the paranoid role. They're listening right now.
Yes.
Did you guys know that? So that part when Kyle MacLachlan sticks that shovel thing into the side of the worm to ride it, and he like pries it, and you see like the innards of the worm a little bit. So like, you know how like it had that like stretched out like gum look?
They
did that. That special effect was done using condoms.
Really?
Yep.
Never. Condoms are used so much in the special effects.
Yeah. You gotta have like a box of them.
Yep.
Yeah.
Just always be prepared. Special effects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. As a special effects guy. You know what's happening? Yeah.
He broke open the scale so the thing automatically rotates to keep its unshielded part of it on top. Uh-huh. That's how you
ride it up.
Fantastic stuff. Maybe?
Yeah.
Okay.
That part of him riding it up was like some of the worst CG in this movie, though, for sure. Like,
the tiny one of him.
Like, it's 100 years before CG.
Yeah, but I mean, well, no, this movie actually had some of the first computer-generated graphics ever. Yeah, the body shields,
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the special effects of him riding it up, it's just like him standing still like this and then moving like things behind him to make it look like he's moving. Yeah.
They even did a little Batman photography as far as like the camera turns sideways and they're climbing up something. That was wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Yep. They're employing like
all the tricks.
Yep. This movie's made in Mexico. It was a Mexican crew and Mexican studios. Carlo Rambaldi, who has done, he designed E.T., I think we said at one point, he designed the King Kong. For Dino De Laurentiis in 1976, did the creature design for this movie.
I liked it. I liked the
Gianetto De Rossi, who like worked on all the Lucio Fulci, you know, Italian splatter movies, was also credited there at the end. So, I mean, like...
I saw the Bright Red Blood.
It's hard to look at the special effects in this movie and consider them. I mean, like, they were the contemporary, I suppose, of its time. But closest competitors, you have to look at like Return of the Jedi, right? 1983, mm-hmm. This is 84. And how well does that stack up against like, you know, the work of ILM, which really was, you know, you look back at it now. I mean, when you look at all the stuff like Star Crash, right?
Yes.
It was a movie that wanted to do outer space stuff and how it compares to Star Wars, you know, like with the whatever model, the Navy
literal,
ships
literal Navy together. Ship models and brackets and everything just glued together.
Yeah, and just flung through whatever the lighted
in there.
Background.
It'll blow up.
And so you have Dune, which is like, it's more advanced than that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going for that kind of distressed, futuristic, you know, look to the ships and all that. Right?
I can see how
the paint jobs.
Right. I can see how the Ridley Scott element you mentioned earlier, or at least knowing his tastes at that point, like why he would be interested in stuff like this. Because when you mention those filmmakers, based on the designs of this movie, they all seem similar at that point. I don't know what. Where I was going with that.
Similar in like what way? Because I mean, a lot of
like you said, the distressed look and the old look, and just sometimes maybe even the model use.
Yeah, maybe
that we see in this movie. I think that's more the model
than the design of them. Because I mean, in this movie, you have like triangle shaped spaceships.
Yes,
which is just like what the fuck, you know? Yeah,
right.
It's just one that has the. It's called the Ornithopter, but it has the. the wings. They come.
All right. Okay.
It's just they're very.
Ornithology is the study of birds, right?
It's supposed to hop. I think like it hops across the desert. That's how. Yeah. Okay. I know. I know too much about Dune. I think that, you know.
And yet still, there's things you don't know. So this movie's
just
too
no
dense.
One can know.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like the movie to me is split into two halves. And
the half
midpoint,
where they drag everything out and the half where they're just like.
Yes. Yeah. Because the midpoint to me occurs when Paul and his mother make it into the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, Father, you know, whatever, and the lightning crashes and all that. That's. Where the intermission goes, right?
Yeah.
The first half is all this, like, there's a plot to kill the Duke.
Yeah.
It's the Harkonnens are somehow, there's sabotage. The Harkonnens have got a traitor in their midst. And, you know, we have to set up what Arrakis is, how the spice mining works, you know, and just basically world building. And then this, like, you
and
know,
we will
intrigue.
Spare no time to it.
And the second half is Paul's ascension through the ranks of the Fremen who adopt him.
Yes.
And
rather quickly, by the way. It's like, you could kill us. You should join us. It's basically, yeah. It's real quick, and he falls in love with Sean Young real quick. It's all very,
his
very
mom
fast.
Becomes their reverend mother.
Yeah, for as much as it's dragged out in the first half of the movie, it all goes smooth sailing right through that second half of that movie.
Yeah, until
all quick.
He has a sister.
Yeah. That's like 6 years old all of a sudden, that last time we heard about, it was my mom's pregnant.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he's got a six-year-old sister. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
She drinks the water and has a half-formed baby.
They did throw in there that she was rapidly growing.
That's true. Right. All that seems to be coming from, like, they had the whole version of it, and they're just like, we need to shorten some of this down somewhere at some point.
They're like, how do we explain that?
His original cut was like 4 hours.
Had to be four hours.
So or his original, whatever, the footage that he shot. He shot like a 4-hour version of the movie that was like, we got to shorten this to 2.
Yeah.
And they got it to 2, whatever.
Why they decided to wait until the second half of the movie, they're just like, all right, let's go. Come on.
Because don't you think, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's a personal thing. I think the first half with the palace intrigue and all that stuff works better. I mean, because there's a little bit of suspense as far as like how all these characters are going to line up and what's going
to
happen.
And there is a plot to a little plot to kill.
Where does the pug go? Yeah. I got it.
Know where Holly's at.
Yeah.
Where's that damn dog? Is that damn dog okay? They better not kill the dog. Whereas the second half then becomes, you know, I don't know what. I mean, the big moments are him learning to ride the sandworms.
Yeah. Him learning to drink the water and become the one.
But this all enters into the realm of like the mystic. And that's where you get more of that impressionistic kind of imagery, and it becomes more surreal and less focused. And I think the attention of the viewer starts to wander because you're not sure what the fuck is going on.
Right. Yeah. All right. There's water underneath everything.
And that just kind of gets left to nowhere.
Right.
Yeah, they have 1,000 caches of water underneath. They're going to change Arrakis somehow. But somehow Paul has at the end of the movie, the magical ability to just call water down from the sky.
Well, that was
his voice. Do you notice he's like humming?
But that was their plan.
That was him?
He was.
I thought that was just
a
weird.
Buried under the music.
It was there.
I thought it was just a weird Toto choice.
But I get the story in the second half. Like, there's the Fremen who are like, they said they have thousands of these caches of water all over the place, and they are going to change Arrakis. And I mean, this is their plan until the one shows up to do what he's supposed to do. Until that point, like, they don't know if it's real or not. So they have like plan B is to collect these caches of water, and it's basically the long way to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
And then Paul shows up, and then it kind of shortens up because he is the one and can help them with the prophecy. There's a prophecy in this movie, by the way.
Of course there is.
Because there's always a prophecy, but there's a prophecy in this movie.
So if we've got Toto doing the soundtrack, and we literally have someone making it rain, why are we not kicking into Africa right as soon as that starts? Like, that would have saved that. I probably would like this movie if they did that.
That's be why they thought of Toto to do the score, right? It's like it's raining in the desert.
Yeah.
Get me Toto. Then pick up the red phone. Get me Toto. Yeah. Now. They're the only ones who can do this.
Yeah.
You can't use that song.
The whole fucking movie I was waiting for that song.
I'm sure someone on YouTube has already done that.
To
that scene of this movie.
Yeah.
Well, we're kind of wrapping this up, I suppose. Are we? Is there a lot more to explore in Dune?
I don't know. We didn't talk about his weird ass little sister, but there's not really much to say.
She was creepy.
Alicia Witt as a young girl.
That's Alicia Witt?
Yes, it's Alicia Witt.
I didn't notice she was a redhead too. When her stuff started falling off. That's Alicia Witt. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting.
He talks very creepy.
Very creepy. It's like,
he is the Quetzal Cataract.
Yeah. And she's like, I talk like this. And Jesus. It was. It scared me. I was very scared. I was not. It was surprising. It's very surprising.
Yep.
You sounded like Louis Armstrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
There it is. I mean, yeah. So it ends. He does make it rain. Oh, he fights Sting at the end.
That's the big thing at the end.
He's like, why Sting? I don't like why he doesn't. I guess this is his last like opponent. He could beat everyone else, but he's still got Sting there.
I think
the other redhead's got his head cut off.
I think Sting was just on the payroll. They're like, well, we got to keep using him.
He says 90 words in this whole movie.
See,
he 90 doesn't have a point. Words.
He like, does. He's there he does.
To be, no, okay, you calm
when,
down.
When he's
there
to
be
up.
Sexy.
Yeah, and his codpiece.
He is. He's there to walk out.
It
and be
is
like,
the weirdest fucking thing in the world. He comes out of a steam room and in a codpiece.
That's it. That's it. Was his major, and then he locked him at the end.
It had like wings. The codpiece.
Yeah, it did. It really did. Yeah. It. So I think my favorite part of this movie is like the very beginning when the sperm larva in a tank comes to deliver the news.
Yeah, we haven't even mentioned this guy yet.
Yeah.
So, what is he?
Because I don't know what he is. I don't know what he does.
So sperm larva
in a space navigator. He's the guy who's been deformed by 4,000 years.
We didn't have this conversation.
And he can time travel.
Just like a Jedi. He folds space.
So the sperm larva in a tank comes and tells them all this really important information. And
he's a talking vagina.
For a mouth.
I always love that they've grown so sophisticated. He's like the brain bug. But they've grown so sophisticated at some point that they don't need limbs. Like,
yeah.
I am so intelligent, I don't need appendages. Yeah.
But I have to be in this tag. I have to be in this tank to stay alive, though.
Yes. And his tank leaves a trail of, like, slime. Yeah. And there's one dude with a mop walking behind.
But my favorite part is after he delivers all his important information about why they need to kill Paul, and then he goes, I was never here. You didn't talk to me, and backs out. And like, he's like this stoic mystical being that knows everything. And then that's how his exit is. Like his exit is, you didn't talk to me.
He's like, Yeah. The guy was so obviously leaving a room.
Yeah.
Not to like, you didn't see.
Yeah. And his exit is so slow. It's comical because that big tank has to slide out after he goes,
that
wasn't me.
Engine that comes into the room. It's like, this guy can fold space and time.
Yeah.
Just
you can
show
be
up.
Anywhere
yeah.
Without
why does
moving?
He just pop right. into existence? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, he has to be like encased in a bunch of spice gas.
Spice gas. And then he's shooting like lasers out of his ass later on to full time.
Yeah.
It was out of his vagina mouth.
Yeah.
The little sperm was shooting space lights out and forming into planets.
How do you fold space?
It's like he was blasting the destinations he wanted to go to. It's like, I want to go there, and there, and put them together.
All right, so what we're talking about is a deficit in the visual storytelling, right? The fact that, like, this doesn't really make... You can't determine by
certain
looking
things,
at these images what the fuck is happening. Like, it must mean something to David Lynch. But, yeah, it's literally, like, what? Like, 3 minutes of him, like, optical effects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where a laser...
A sperm is shooting lasers.
Out of his mouth.
Yeah. And they turn into planets.
Yeah. And then magically the ship appears in the orbit of Arrakis.
But it's like a cut to that. There's no correlation between that happening and causing this. It's just like, oh, now there's a ship there.
Yeah, it was more like
it felt like the ship was already going there, and now we're cutting to a different scene.
It was more like a
scene
change,
yeah. We're showing the mechanism of how it works, and then cutting to the end result, and then, you know, or the destination.
Right.
Because I actually didn't realize they were related to just the second.
But that's what I'm saying. If it's not conveyed, then you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? As a director.
Oh, no. Talking about the floating battery. Like the long, it was like a battery looking thing. It looked like a Duracell commercial.
Yeah,
it's something.
All of their ships go into it.
I didn't realize that was transported.
The sperm we're all just hanging out at odd angles in space. Like they could at least line up or something.
The sperm was in that thing somewhere the center of it. Yeah, where all that lights and shit was. Yeah. Okay.
I promise I watched this movie.
Yeah.
Well, we've gone out about an hour trying to solve the mysteries of Dune. Maybe no one ever will. We don't know. But, want to say something else?
I was going to say, Denis Villeneuve will try.
He's going to try.
He'll try. I mean, if there's anybody equipped to do it, it's probably him.
Yeah.
Because Ridley Scott, I don't think, would have the patience to give his time for that. Well, I mean, but I don't think he would go back and try at this point.
Yeah. went on to Blade Runner.
But then Denis Villeneuve did that as well. So like he's the guy at this point to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is this a waste of time at this point?
The images in his mind for 35 years. So it's basically since he saw the David Lynch Dune, he was like, I could do this better. Maybe we're going to see, you know.
Now I am all, God damn it. Thank you, Colin. I am now interested in seeing the Denis Villeneuve Dune.
Yeah, we have to see it.
I'm like, I have to compare. Yeah. I almost really want to see the miniseries now. And
it's on YouTube.
I'm going to find it. I have to see the comparison. I have to now. This is a thing. I want to know if somebody can make it clearer or what they can do with this material and to other filmmakers, what they view as a necessity that has to stay in compared to this one and what goes to get across the same story. Mm-hmm. Now I have to see it.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I feel like Denis Villeneuve handles pacing incredibly well.
Yes.
So that's it. I think that's really important since we were just talking about how horrible the pacing is in this movie. So I think that he might leave a lot out compared to this movie, but the pacing will feel much more acceptable to a viewer.
But that'll be the difference.
Have to explain. I mean, like somehow, how do you convey this information? Mm-hmm. I mean, especially I mean, visually, and just in the language and all that, how do you, I mean, you have to delve into it to somehow, you know, so they can understand what you're talking about.
I can imagine.
It's so abstract.
Right. But I can imagine what they're going to do beforehand is in, for this version, they had to take stuff out after the fact, whereas I assume that Villeneuve and his team are going to go in and look at it and extract the things in the writing process and what they can make, you know, put more of a put together more. Like, we don't need this. We can connect these two. We don't need this. We can connect these two. I think if they're smart, this is what they should do, I feel. Make it shorter in that process, way early on.
It desperately needs to be stripped, condensed, and connected.
Right. That's what they need to do first off. They didn't do that for this one. You can tell just by the pacing in this movie that they had to take chunks out as, you know, after everything. In the new one, I feel they'll have to take it out before. And I think in that way, they might be able to... knowing very little about this, they might be able to make a universe out of this that is somewhat coherent. Maybe.
Was that your final wrap?
It was. You can just skip me for the next one. That's fine. Everything I just said now, plus I don't recommend Dune. I guess that's it. Like, I don't...
haven't done Mailbag yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so hang on.
Oh, no! I just want to get it out now! Okay, go.
All right, so tune in in a minute for our final wrap-up.
Sean does things his own way.
First of all, we're going to summon Igor the mailman. Igor, where are you, sir?
Masters, the mail. I've got the mail. So many letters. Our followers are rising.
Why, thank you, Igor.
Thanks, Igor.
Hey, if you want, we're going to read some mail that we've received
from
various social media. If you want to get a hold of us, you can get a hold of us on Facebook at facebook.com/Saturday Night Freak Show or on Twitter
at Sat Freak Show
or the old fashioned way. You can email us directly
SaturdayNightFreakShow@yahoo.com.
We need something from Michaela.
It's going to be like Instagram
probably. Right. Yeah.
Set up the Instagram account.
Or give her the Facebook one. Like, you just leave us all off. Facebook.
Or just go right around. Okay. Mm-hmm. So here's what we've got. First of all, about Dune.
Dune.
Andrew Kelpfus writes in and says, Dune is actually one of my favorite movies. I read the book first, so I was able to follow the movie pretty well. Matthew Pearson writes in and said, Dune is his favorite book. I have read it half a dozen times now. Even with the discrepancies, I like the movie as well. And Hosby Trippin. Says, growing up, my local TV station used to air a wide range of sci-fi movies every Saturday afternoon, from Blade Runner to 50s B-movies such as Tarantula, and I sat through all of them, except for one, Dune.
There's also three poop emojis after that, too.
Yes.
After the Dune, there was three poop emojis.
Who submitted that?
Hosby Trippin.
Yeah. Okay, so you can comment on any show that we've done, including some of our past episodes. Metaluna Zombie, a user who was listening to us on YouTube, commented on Rock and Roll Nightmare, past episode, and said, this is among the best. Now, I don't know if Metaluna means the show or the movie?
We'll say the show.
I'm going to say the show.
There you go.
We'll say the show.
Because that movie's definitely
Thank
not.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's no way she meant the movie. Thank he you. Meant the movie. Whatever.
All right, for My Bloody that Valentine. That was that rock and roll nightmare. For My Bloody Valentine, Dom Cree said he's very impressed by Michaela and Holly's rating scales for this episode.
Yeah.
As for Sean and Colin, time to up your rating.
Oh, call snap.
Okay.
Called out.
Yeah. All right, Dom.
He says it's also great to see more people discovering the brilliance of the show. Thank you very much, Dom.
Thanks, Dom.
Thanks, Dom.
Chris Huddleston says he watched The Prowler for the first time recently, and you're right, it's pretty crappy. He'd heard good things about it and was very disappointed. Any members of the Freak Show buying these classic horror soundtrack reissues really quickly, a correction. We said that we were trying to find a My Bloody Valentine soundtrack.
And it does exist.
Does exist. Yep. By Waxwork Records. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty nice release. This one of those,
it is.
It's one of those niche companies who, like, they take their time to acquire, like, they go back and find master tapes and all this stuff and do re-releases of old horror soundtracks. Waxwork is specifically old horror soundtracks. Mm-hmm. And they've done probably 30 over the past couple years. And we found a My Bloody Valentine one, which is a very nice release. Red vinyl records and great detail in the artwork. We all sat around here once we figured it out. We're like, ooh, I want that.
Did you buy it?
I didn't buy that one.
Chris is asking.
I didn't buy that one.
And the artwork is by...
Ghoulish Gary Pullen.
Yeah, Gary Pullen, who's a friend of mine, also does artwork for Mondo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he does artwork for Mondo a lot of times. He does artwork for, he's a huge horror fan. He's Canadian.
Ah,
he
must have had some pride in doing that one.
Yeah, but like he doesn't have a very noticeable accent, I've noticed. So he's a great guy. He's a good artist. Like you can always tell his stuff because it looks heads and tails above everybody else's
good.
Artwork.
Legit. Yeah,
so
good looking art. Good.
Yeah. Go check out his stuff.
And the Ballad of Harry Warden. I mean,
you can't. That's worth the price alone. Yeah,
podcast for a stirring rendition of part of that song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so worth it.
But I did buy recently. They reissued the Thing soundtrack, which I did purchase for an excessive amount of money. I'm not going to say how much, but worth it.
Does your wife know how much you spent on
it? Nope, she doesn't even know I bought it. Shut up.
So
we
answer...
got taxes back, okay? Just don't rat me out, all right?
So the answer, Chris, is yes.
We are buying them.
He also says he recently signed up for Shudder, which has a pretty extensive giallo selection, since we're talking about it.
Cool.
He says he's seen most of the Argento films and watched Bava's Bay of Blood a few nights ago. What are some other must-sees that I should check out?
Colin? This is all you.
Giallo?
The red giallo. Something? Red? Something's red?
Deep red.
Deep red.
Yeah, that's Blood and Black Tenebrae. Lace is my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that one a lot.
But outside of the Argento
stuff? No, I only know the really mainstream stuff, so.
Check out The Case of the Bloody Iris, if you can find that one, with Edvige Fennec and... Case of the Bloody Iris.
Were you not here for our giallo name?
Sounds like a
naming,
Sherlock Holmes.
Is it? You played a game with us in one of them. I think it was when
is it giallo or not?
Did we watch Tenebrae?
Yeah.
When we watched Tenebrae, it was is it giallo or is it made up or something like
all
that?
All the colors of the dark.
Yeah.
The lizard with lizard in the woman's skin.
Right. The bird with the crystal plumage or something.
Four flies on gray velvet.
Yeah.
Another one you should check out, Chris, is if they have it, What Have You Done to Solange? That's another good giallo.
What did they do
movie.
To Solange?
I can't tell you. Right? You got to find out. All right. So now we're going to give you our final wrap ups on Dune, starting with Sean. Go.
Okay. Dune. I mean, like we said, the pacing of this movie to me, it's a little lopsided, as we said. They take their time in the first half of the movie, and then it feels like they're rushing through it in the second half. When we're first introduced to kind of the world that they're creating here in this movie, they're throwing stuff at you pretty quick, pretty fast, and it's hard to – you can kind of understand the general sense of what people are doing if you can't remember the names of everybody. But, I mean, I got the story of what was going on, but the movie – I mean, I think it's too – long, although based on what we know about the books and everything, I don't know how this could be a short movie. I do like, the cast is very good. The visuals, This one's a hard movie for me. I don't think I would recommend it just because, like, I don't think I would ever watch this again. Yeah, that's a hard one. But it does pique my interest in the fact that I want to see, like, other versions of this. Because, like Colin said, this is, like, a code people are still trying to crack. I don't think I get, like, the want to see this movie. Like, I don't get why this particular thing is so popular in science fiction. I don't know why people are still attracted to this. Because it doesn't seem that... And this is looking at it, you know... 30 something years on, I don't understand the attraction to it and why people would keep going back to it.
It was a product of the hippie generation.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely a product of its time. Visuals are interesting. The story is, I think, overly long. I think the visuals are the biggest selling point of this movie. The sandworms and all that, I found – I mean, that's a great design. I would like it a lot. But as far as story goes, I don't think I will – I'll do everything I can to not watch this movie again. I think that's the best way to put it. I won't sit through this again. I can't do it. I'll check out some alternate versions of it just as a comparison's sake, but I can't recommend Dune. No, I wouldn't want anybody to sit through this. It didn't do enough for me. There wasn't enough there to hook me in. So no, I pass on Dune.
I just kept thinking. First of all, I kept thinking of this movie really reminding me of Flash Gordon in a lot of ways. And then Colin and
he'll save every one of us.
I know I missed Queen.
But then, it didn't have a song. Where's the Dune song?
I know. Yeah.
It was Brian Eno.
I was going to talk about that.
It was horrible.
Okay. Colin did mention that this was produced by the same guy who...
Dino De Laurentiis.
Yes. And he also did Flash Gordon. So that explains...
This is produced by like all the De Laurentiises. There was a number of them in this credit sequence.
I know.
Even the dead one at the beginning.
The dead one. Yes. Yeah, dedicated to him.
Dead De Laurentiis.
The dead.
Dedicated to the dead De Laurentiis. Yeah. I just kept thinking, this movie was so fucking long. It was so long. I kept thinking, I had only seen pictures of like them walking around in the desert. And I kept thinking, this is still going, and they haven't walked in the desert yet.
There's certain landmarks you can gauge it by, and just like, they're still not in the desert.
Oh my God, they're not walking in the desert yet. This is taking forever. I agree with Colin that it can be separated timeline-wise. But the first one just seemed so long. And I don't know. It just didn't really do it for me. It was pretty boring. I think probably because it was so fucking confusing. I was really confused this whole movie. I did really appreciate the production value. I thought the sets were fantastic. The costumes were really spot on. They were really intricate. I definitely appreciated that about this. It was impressive. Like, it was such a grand scale. Everything was. And I dug the sandworms. Thought that was cool. They were a little phallic for my taste, since everything else was very...
I mean, when is a worm not phallic?
I mean this especially.
There were a bunch of men riding them into...
It opens up and there's rows and layers of flesh inside of it and a bunch of...
Yours doesn't do that?
I'm saying you're not going to find one that does.
A cat's penis is barbed, just like that.
Yep.
What? So,
cats have barbed penises. That's why it sounds so painful when cats...
This is something everybody else knew. So they can hook in and not...
Yeah, yeah, that's why it sounds so... That's why they yowl so much.
That's why it's so horrifying to hear happen. Yeah, thank you for knowing that. It's like
duck penises are corkscrewed too. Yeah, like these are things I know.
This,
like,
Sean's reaction is why we need to live stream this stuff.
I have to go home and separate my cats.
I love that me and Michaela are like, why do they know this?
Yeah. This is like Snapple cap knowledge, guys.
I mean, I've Googled a lot of things. I've never been like, cat penises.
Yeah. You don't Google that. You just know.
It's just something you pick up.
It's something you pick up on the street, Sean.
I wonder why it sounded looked as like a such a. That's why my the female cat keeps running away from the male.
Yeah,
cat.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I bet Hose be tripping knew. I bet
Hose
he knew.
Be tripping.
Hose be tripping probably knew that. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So.
You were disturbed by the phallic looking.
There's a lot of gender biases and just genitalia type creatures. It's weird. I don't know. This movie was weird as fuck. It was really confusing. I can't recommend it. I give it maybe one floaty space sperm. One.
Out of?
Just one lonely one.
I don't know, five.
Out of 10. What's the matter? It's one.
Well, I mean, one out of one four of, isn't bad.
No, one out of two one out is five, half. Not really.
One out of four one out is of still ten not is great. One out of four is still not great.
Dom Cree's going to get on you and me for our rating system.
I got one. I'm ready. You
I'm the one who started this rating system.
Needed
and everyone else has hijacked it.
Yeah. All right. I'm sorry.
So I historically have hated this movie. But I really hate this movie.
Yet watched it so many times.
Yeah. Well, I dated a guy for 2 months, and in the 2 months that we dated, I think we watched this like 4 or 5 times because this was his
that's
favorite.
Why it was only 2 months.
This was his favorite movie. And like, no, when you're in that stage of dating, you're not going to be like, oh,
I have to ask, you actually watched it?
Yeah, no, okay. Like actually watched. And then when that I was sucks. In college, in a there was like a film studies class I was in. Guess what movie I had to write a fucking paper on? This movie. So like, I just, and like when you can't even understand the movie writing a paper on, it's like I
no
don't fucking know.
Michaela.
Yeah.
Girl.
Yeah. So that being said, I tried to go into it like, not thinking about that college paper, that ex-boyfriend, and just watch this movie. And I think the Blu-ray actually really helps it a lot to note, like, bump up the production value. And like, there are groundbreaking things that did happen in this movie, but there are better David Lynch movies. There are better sci-fi movies. Mm-hmm. And I think this would actually be better served as like the Westworld treatment, like a mini HBO miniseries with a gigantic budget, a huge budget, but they have the time to let the story unfold, you know, and they don't have to like crunch it down within a cinematic time frame. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I feel like a Westworld type series would be best served. However, I don't see HBO willing to throw the money at it because I mean. This movie, for people who haven't seen this movie, know that it's not good. Like, even people that haven't seen it are like, oh, yeah, I heard it's terrible. Like,
Or that it's troubled, if nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. So I can't see it being a commodity that a network like HBO would be willing to take a chance on.
Sci-fi did it.
Sci-fi has considerably less money. Yeah, exactly.
The Sci-Fi Channel is an entity all on its own.
Yeah. They also do how many Sharknado movies, you know? So, yeah.
They just buy those. They pay the money for them. That's the asylum, man.
Right. But, so I wouldn't recommend it. I would say there's an episode of Futurama where they go to a desert planet and Fry becomes king of water people. And that's a better version of Dune than this movie. So I would say go watch the Futurama episode or, you know, just there's so many better sci-fi movies and better David Lynch movies. I feel bad that this is Sean's first David Lynch movie. Yeah, I feel like you got to wash that taste out of your mouth.
Yeah. I mean, it hasn't put me off wanting to explore other David Lynch movies.
Yeah.
But,
there's definitely some similarities, but not...
Sure, but I can't imagine, like, none of them look on... None of them look... This seems to me like an anomaly in his work.
Yeah. It definitely is.
Well, that's... Well, yeah, like,
so
this seems like...
a straight story. You know
yeah.
I mean?
Like, but, yeah, but at least
there's
those are, like, more grounded in a human story, not a...
There's definitely a David Lynch spice.
Yeah. The thing David Lynch does best...
You get a 5-minute timeout. No more... You will know.
The thing that David Lynch does best is showing you a small town and then showing you like all the grossness that lies beneath that small town. That's what he does best. And that's what, and I think that's what he likes doing best. Cause that comes through in his work. So like, this is a huge, you know, yeah, like you said, anomaly in his career. And I don't think anyone judges his career solely on this, thankfully. I don't think
he'd be working.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
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 Him.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I don't recommend it.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No,
so that's a no.
Still don't,
Colin. What do you think of the movie you picked?
All right, so yeah, the reason I picked it is because it is an anomaly. I think not only in David Lynch's filmography, which you know, watching it now, I'm seeing more of David Lynch in it. But it's not the David Lynch of Blue Velvet. It's more the David Lynch of like Eraserhead. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that Eraserhead vibe and the kind of the dream stuff, which I guess I see in Lost Highway is a very nightmarish kind of dream mm-hmm. thing. You know, Fire Walk with Me and Mulholland Drive. It's less the David Lynch of Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet or Elephant Man or whatever, you know. So it's like I still feel that he's there, but this is like it's diluted, you know. This is David Lynch like watered way down because I think he's trying to serve the corporate, you know, idea of what a gigantic, expensive space opera is supposed to be. It's a very operatic movie, which I think is cool. There's all these idiosyncrasies, which I don't think they play well. And I think, you know, obviously I'm in a room full of people tonight who saw it and just rejected it. Like, so I get that. But on the flip side of looking at it, it's like the stuff that he's doing is so weird. And maybe this is what he was setting out to do. It's like, I'm going to make a movie that's so weird that it will have nothing to compare it to, you know, which
it will stand alone.
Yeah, it kind of does have that in some ways. I mean, there's echoes of maybe 2001 in there a little bit where I was like, okay, this could be, you know. But in some of the, you know, the space faring parts of it, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm thinking of the image of the ship, the bone-shaped ship showing up, but like the Discovery showing up outside of Arrakis or whatever in space. The first half of the movie, I got to tell you, actually does work for me. And I think that's why I like the film. And probably why I would recommend it because, like, you know, I like the Jürgen Prochnow character of the Duke. I like the interplay between Paul and all the weird people, the Brad Dourif character. And, you know, like all the way all these characters interact in the first half where it's setting up the universe, even though the special effects, you got to look past. Okay, and if you can't, then you're out. You know, it's not going to happen because it's a combination of like, you know, these 80s style blue screen special effects and really odd designs, which I sit there going like, this is odd and doesn't work. This looks ridiculous. You've got like this T-bone shaped spaceship that has a core that drops down and that's how you get into it. And it's just like, this is completely impractical. I don't buy it. Fuck it. Years later, I remember these images are like burned into my, like the style of the ships in this. I'm like, I don't like them. Why do I remember them so well? Like somehow, like, you know, I mean like that ship with all the lights, you know, on the front of it, the windows that are like slashed into it. It's kind of a bulbous thing with the, the wings coming out of it. It's like, I remember these things like years on is like, that's a distinct look. Like that's Dune. That's Dune. That's Dune. That's David Lynch's Dune. The costumes, the hairstyles, it's like all of that is very specific to this movie. So I think he did achieve like a uniqueness in science fiction films of that time. So on that basis, I'm kind of recommending it. However, I have severe reservations because I think the second act collapses. And I think the reason why it collapses is because we're not being told the entire story. The editing is telescoping the story so much that it's incomprehensible almost, you know, I mean, again, I think it's just me. I don't have a problem with a lot of things catching, you know, Lannister and Stark and, you know, who all these people are, or in this, you know, it's like, I can pick out, you know, it's like, I know what they're talking about. You know, I understand the language of this movie. So it was like, I'm following it. I'm like, I know who everybody is. But I guess, you know, I'm aware that nobody else is like, you know, picking this stuff up. And I see that that's a problem with the movie. I see that's where I think Villeneuve is going to have his problem, you know, creating that kind of translation. Either you are familiar with the material. And I noticed our commenters who said they had read the book, like the movie, because it basically does function as a Reader's Digest condensed version of the book. I mean, it does hit all the beats and the book is there. It's just, you know, that toward the end when they start introducing the sound weapons and I think, you know, there's the big battle and there's a lot of stuntmen running around and I'm like, you're not visually selling it in a way that's easily you know, understood, I think. You know, it's murky, dark, you know, looking photography. It's like, I don't know, it just kind of deteriorates. There's a romance that, like, is happening just because we have to have a romance. You know, it's like, I don't feel it at all. There's no connection there. It's like, I recognize that Paul has to have a, you know, a wife at some point.
But there was no moment for them.
Yeah. It's just like, it happened at some point, like, in, and as an afterthought. Yeah. So they sacrifice that storyline to advance, you know, the overthrow of the emperor. We're going to bring the emperor down and attack him. Okay, well, that's where the saga has to end. So we're going to throw out everything else to get to there. And so I think ultimately the whole enterprise collapses under its own weight. And I haven't seen the extended version in so many years. I couldn't tell you if that one fixes the problems.
It's an extended version?
Yeah, didn't I tell you? It was on TV. They put the they put it out as a two-night thing, put a bunch of stuff back in. Oh, I remember the opening of the extended version uses like concept art to explain for like 10 minutes.
Wow.
The story of like what is going on. It explains who all, it's like the glossary comes first for 10 minutes and then you get into the movie and it takes out the princess narrating everything, but it adds in a bunch of scenes. So it's more of Dune. That was available on, it was available on DVD at one point, the Alan Smithy cut, which was written by Judas Booth. I'm using air quotes because it's David Lynch's pseudonym also. And I think that's like, it's fairly valuable now. You can't really find it cheap, the extended version of David Lynch's Dune. I think, you know, obviously it has a following because I think the story does have a resonance. Just being like one of these kind of mythical, you know, the Messiah story, the savior story, the, you know, in a science fiction area, you know, the a science fiction world, which is really well developed, you know, like George R. R. Martin has done with A Song of Ice and Fire. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, Herbert thought out like all the different components of this universe. And I think, you know, because of all this, the novel has endured for, what are we going on, like 50-odd years or something like that. So, I don't know. I'm curious about the Villeneuve movie, but I don't think – I think the deck is stacked against him. I don't think you can translate this into a 2 to 3 hour feature film. I think, you know, Michaela's idea there, you know, you make this as an 8-episode or 8-hour movie, or, you know, it goes on, you adapt more of the books, you know, is probably the way to go. I don't know. I think I would recommend that you check out Dune as a
project.
No, as like an example of, you know, just a bizarre and odd relic of, you know, this period in science fiction filmmaking. So yeah, that's my wrap up on Dune. That's 2.5 Gam Jabbars of 4.
I don't know what a Gam
Jabbar is. I don't know what that is.
Yep.
That was the little that was don't the know. Needle that she put at the back of his neck. Oh. So this is the Gam Jabbar.
Oh.
There you go. Yep. Okay, that was my shot at it. Next week, Sean's gonna pick the movie. Yep. Sean, what are we watching? Metal Storm, Metal Storm.
We are not watching Metal Storm, you son of a bitch. We are going to watch Jennifer Aniston and Warwick Davis in Leprechaun.
Yes! Shut up. Yes.
Is St. Patrick's Day coming up?
It's coming up.
All right, then.
Got to pick it.
So that's next week on the Saturday Night Freak Show, ladies and germs. And until then, the basement is going dark.